Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
New year, same extra value meals at McDonald's. So now get 2 snack wraps plus fries and a medium soft drink for just $8.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
Hello, and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by James Lavish. James is a hedge fund manager. He spent his career in that industry. But more recently, he's pivoted to running his own Bitcoin-orientated hedge fund. And he's a very prominent commentator on the macro position of what the US is currently going through, and specifically the debt crisis that the US and the UK and other Western countries are currently heading into. So this is going to be a fantastic interview. Let's pick it up with James. Guys, there was a little bit of signal lag in this one, so there's a teeny tiny bit of me and James talking over each other a bit in this one, but hope it doesn't interrupt your enjoyment of what is actually a pretty great episode. Thank you so much for joining us on Brokenomics.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Appreciate it. So, James, I do want to ask you about the debt spiral, which is something that we've hinted at on this channel a number of times, but we've never really sort of broken it down into too much detail. But before I ask you about that, I just got to ask, you know, why is it that we are having to have this conversation in the first place? What is it about the US and its satrapies like the UK that have got them into this sort of disastrous problem in the first place?
Absolutely reckless management at the central bank level.
Okay, you put the...
We're just going to dive right into that. Yeah.
But you put the blame primarily at the central bank level as opposed to the sort of the government and the voters, perhaps, because, I mean, there's some really big line items in there.
All right. Yeah. So I joke, but the reality is that, it's just reckless spending at the legislative level. You know, we joke about the central bank and the treasury being the problem, but you're 100% correct, is that it's spending to the point where you have to just continue to issue debt to cover all of your deficits. And so, yeah, that's something I wrote about last year, I think a year ago, last August. And, you know, it's called the debt spiral. And we've seen it happen in a number of countries before. But the reality is we operate, the United States and Europe, the UK, we're operating at deficits, you know, but focusing in on the US, the deficits are so large that the only way for us to continue to operate is to issue more debt to cover those deficits. And as you issue more debt and you have inflation at the same time, and you have a central bank that's raising rates, you create larger deficits. And it's because your interest rates, your interest costs rise. And so if you're looking at the numbers today, you know, we're approaching $1 trillion of interest expenses just this year for the US. Yeah. Now to put that in context, you know, that's about that we spend about $800 to $850 billion a year on defense spending. So This is now a larger line item than defense spending. And at some point, it will be the largest line item on our books. And so, but when you operate in a deficit, just to keep it simple for your viewers, you know, as debt matures, you don't have the capital, you don't have the cash to pay for that debt because you don't make enough money to pay for all your expenses, right? Mm. So you've got to issue more debt to pay down that debt. And so you just continuously, and now you do this at higher rates, your interest expenses rise. But the reality is, you know, we're operating at these perpetual deficits, and it's for a number of reasons, but it's excessive spending, like you put it. Yep.
So you've got a fantastic newsletter. So what's the name of the newsletter again?
It's called The Informationist. Yeah.
The Informationist. Yeah. So viewers can find that on your Substack. Now, I think you made the interesting point on a recent newsletter that the US lost its AAA credit rating. And when you compare the US to some of the other things that were in the bracket that it came out of, something like Microsoft, Microsoft is running at something like 48 times interest cover to the amount of interest that it has to pay, whereas the US is down at just 5. So, you know, you can see the sort of problem they've got. I mean, what sort of deficit is the US running at the moment? It's about 2 billion, isn't it?
Yeah,
$2 trillion.
And if you pull out the expenses that are the mandatory expenses, you know, so you kind of break it up into three categories, right? So if the United States was a company trading on the New York Stock Exchange, of course it's not. I know some people say it's a ridiculous comparison, but just to visualize it for people, the United States would be considered a zombie company. And what does that mean? That means that we're not generating enough revenue to cover our interest expense. So we're just a zombie issuing more debt to pay down old debt, right? And so to put it all into context, you've got three categories. You've got your mandatory expenses, which is like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. You know, those are legislatively passed. They're absolutely mandatory. You can't miss payments on those, right? Then you've got your defense spending, which is basically a mandatory expense. These are long-term contracts with with defense contractors and companies. So you have to pay.
That's the US dollars version of proof of work, isn't it? The Defense Department. So you can't let that go.
Right. Our 11 aircraft carriers. Exactly. Yeah. So, and then you've got your interest expense, right? And those are three that you can't really trip up. Right. So, but when you look at all of it, we're running deficits that are over $1 trillion now. Okay. So our deficits are up like 50% from last year. So, or more than that now, over 100%. So our issue here is that what can you do? Well, you basically have three choices, right? Dan, you've got three choices. You could either have austerity, which is lowering expenses, cutting programs, and that's pretty much political suicide, because this is what each party is trying to trick the other party into doing, is cutting expenses that will hurt their constituents and cost them votes, right? So that's why you have the debt ceiling. Every single, you know, every few years, we bump up against that debt ceiling, and there's a whole big fight about who's going to cut expenses, and nobody wants to. So it never happens. Again, it didn't happen this time. You know, we didn't cut expenses. We just said, okay, well, we're not going to allow for new expenses, but we're not going to have a limit on the debt quite yet. We'll revisit that, right? So the second thing you could do is raise taxes. And so by raising taxes, you eventually just wind up cutting productivity, because you disincentivize companies to produce more, and you actually hurt their growth, because they can't reinvest that capital into research and development, into new programs, into new, you know, more workers and more employment. You wind up getting to the same spot on your GDP if you raise taxes, okay, or even worse if you raise them enough. Mm. And the third thing you could do, which they always do, is issue more debt to pay it down, okay? But the unspoken thing that they can do, and this is the real third choice, which is as you issue that debt, you allow for higher structural inflation that's long term, that winds up, it debases your currency, right? So, and so that debt is being paid down with dollars that are cheaper. They're worth less than when you issued that debt. So if I loaned you $100 today, and you took that at 3%, and then in 10 years you paid that back to me after paying me that 3% coupon, who do you think won that trade? Well, you did, because you got the benefit of the dollars today, and now in 10 years you're paying me back dollars that are worth far less than they were just when I loaned that to you. So, and that's the government's play, is to allow for long-term structural inflation. They talk about inflation being under control. They talk about, the Fed talks about keeping inflation in check and being sure that it stays at that 2% magic range of 2-3%, however they came up with that. But how did they come up with that? They know that they need to instill confidence in that debt to keep the whole charade going. So they don't want to trip up people and allow that light bulb to go off in their head that says, wait a minute, these dollars.
You need to maintain the illusion that they are going to get paid back in something.
It's an illusion. Yeah. It's a shell game.
Can I just tease on that, sort of managing this through the inflation? Because I'm just thinking about those big line items that you talked about. So I don't know how Medicare and Medicaid works, but if it's anything like the NHS in the UK, the promise is not we are going to provide you a fixed amount of money. It is we are going to provide healthcare goods and services. And the problem is that you can't inflate those away. And that's why we're going for essentially longer and longer waiting lists, which I suppose is preferable to the Canadian version of please go and kill yourself if you develop a toothache or whatever it is. But then those other line items. So interest expense. You can inflate away the value of the debt. But then your military, again, you can't inflate that away. You have to be able to project the amount of force that you need to project in order to maintain the dollar. There's so much that you can do with inflation, but the problem is that you actually need to provide something real on most of these. I mean, I'm presuming you tell me if I'm wrong, but you can't inflate away your Medicare and Medicaid expenses that much, because it's essentially a promise of real things.
That's right. And so here, what we do is we get a statement every single year. You can go in and look at your Social Security benefits, their expected benefits. And, my mom is on, she's getting her Social Security check. She's 80 years old. And so she knows what she's getting. She's planning for that. Can you imagine, she's okay, but can you imagine if that was her main source of income, if they cut that in half? I mean, that would be devastating. And so they can't do that. They know that. So, I mean, I'm Gen X, right? So yeah. I don't expect to get much, right? And you're a little bit younger than me, but I don't expect to get much from the government, right? So I expect them to somehow, bleed away this program, and just because we're looking at over $200 trillion of obligations in the United States. When you add in all of those Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, when you add all that up, those are unfunded liabilities.
I think it comes out to something like 500,000 per US citizen or something like that.
Yeah, it's something insane. So if you go to debtclock.com, you can see it for your listeners. But they've got it all broken down by people and by the federal and the local, and you can see everything on there. It's actually a really good thing. And then those numbers come right off the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office. So,
But that raises an interesting question where you talk about the sort of the generational differences in this, because effectively what we've got at the moment is we've got a set of entitlements in the UK and US, which, realistically are not going to survive the baby boomer generation if they even make it all the way through there. Like you said, Gen X and below, there's very little prospect of getting anything out of these programs. So what you're essentially asking...
That we paid in for 30 years plus.
But you're essentially asking several generations of Westerners. You're saying, we need you to pay sky-high taxes, and on top of that, we're going to inflate your money away so that your wages are always going to be lagging behind this. And in return, you're going to get nothing. It seems very difficult to hold this up, even over the short to medium term.
Yeah, it's cynical, So what are they going to do? They know they can't really do that. So they allow for that inflation, and that illusion is there to and to allow them to continue to issue more debt. Now, that spotlight that got put on the, you know, the debt ceiling, once again, it spurred the one of the credit agencies to Fitch this time to downgrade the U.S. debt. Okay, so let's talk about that. Because you've got people like Warren Buffett and Jamie Dimon saying it doesn't matter, it's nonsense, the U.S. is that. Okay, in one sense, the United States is, we have the, you know, the privilege of being the both the reserve, the global reserve asset and the global reserve currency of the world. Like, so we have that benefit. And so when you have economic issues, you have market drawdowns, market scares, and people want to run to safety. Where do they run? They run to treasuries. They run to short-term treasuries typically. And so the money pours in for the United States when there's uncertainty, and that's just reality. Now, backing off of that though, when you ask why would they do this? Why would the S&P downgrade the US debt in 2011? Why would Fitch downgrade US debt in 2023? And where's S&P? And the S&P, I don't know what they're thinking, but the reality is there's a lot of different components that go into that. And one of the components is whether or not they trip the debt ceiling and they end up having a technical default, right? So what is that? We have a real default where they just cannot pay or refuse to pay the either coupon or the principal on the debt. The U.S. will not do that. There's no reason for it to do that. We issue debt in our own currency. And as other countries like the U.K. and the Europe, okay, you're issuing debt in your currencies. So you can always monetize that debt. Look at what's happening in Japan. And we can come back to that. But the reality is we would never have a real default, at least not unless we have a massive hyperinflationary event and there's just no way around it. Okay, so what's a technical default? Well, they miss a payment. We've done this before. In 1979, Congress couldn't get their act together, and they dragged all the way to the last moment to raise the debt ceiling. And they finally raised the debt ceiling. Well, it's 1979. We didn't have computers. The Treasury didn't have computers. So they were stuffing envelopes with checks that were for the principal and for the interest right. payments on debt. And they put them in the mail and it wasn't in time. So they missed it. They missed
it. So technically a default, yep.
There was technically a default. Now they made everybody whole, but the problem is it's a technical default. But think about it today. Okay, you could argue, it doesn't matter. They'll just press a button. Everybody's paid, even at the last second, even at 11:59, right? Well, that may be true, but if they technically default, even just for a day or two, you know, that initiates chaos in markets. Why? Because people use the U.S. Treasury as collateral.
Yes.
Right. And you are borrowing against that collateral and you're expecting to get, you know, payments. You may be expecting to have cash that you need to pay something else.
So there's the whole chain of payments throughout the financial system.
You trigger and it produces cash. So it's not nothing. It matters when you have a technical default. Hmm. And so you have counterparty risk. You have, and people will have a chain linked event where you have other defaults that happen. They may be technical and everything gets sorted out, but it's a mess. So it's not nothing. And so it produces opportunity costs. So what happens? Markets drop. You don't have your money from your treasury. You want to take advantage of the fact the market's dropping, but the counterparty is the U.S. Treasury, which is the safest asset in the world. You don't have money from them, so you can't invest in the market drop. You just had counterparty risk that turned into opportunity costs that now, you know, you've lost out on because the treasury didn't pay you in time.
So this is the example of the credit event that you feel might be coming fairly soon.
I mean that could have been last spring. We could have had that, but that didn't come to fruition. But the point is that Fitch is saying it's more likely that the U.S. defaults on U.S. treasuries than even a technical default, then Microsoft misses a payment on their debt. That's what they're saying. And that's scary, but it's probably true. Now, the reality is that if the US defaulted on their debt, it would ripple into Microsoft. So it would be a problem for them too. But this is the reality. Okay. And that's what they're saying. And then they're saying also, and it's an unspoken, you know, part of this analysis that they've done. But if you go in there and you look at the what the different factors are that they look at, and they have it right on their website. I've got it in my newsletter. You can look at all the different things they look at for sovereign debt. And some of it is is debt to GDP, you know, just how much of those interests are as a percentage of your income. They're looking at all these things and how much that inflation is, how structural that inflation is, and they know exactly what we talked about, which is the third type of default. And that's the soft default. And they're doing it every day. They're soft defaulting every day by debasing the currency and making those dollars they pay you back worth less than when you lent it to them.
Period. So who's going to be buying all of this debt? Because, I mean, sooner or later, I mean, I appreciate there's a whole that the US Treasuries, they're sort of a backbone of the financial system because they're used as a way to sort of storing money over, well, short to long-term periods. And so I appreciate that they're a sort of a backbone of this. But this soft default is becoming more and more obvious. So who's going to continue to buy this? Because what we're seeing is declining overseas purchases. The US could do something like financial repression where it goes to its institutions, its pension funds, its insurance funds and saying, okay, you have to own a certain percentage of US treasuries and then simply grow that percentage. The problem with that, though, is that it sort of feels like we all kind of know what we should be doing, which is waiting for the taps to turn on, for printer to arrive again, go out and buy a big bag of risk and then basically watch that shoot up. But if they go down the financial repression route of saying, OK, now everybody has to buy this, well, that means they have to sell something else. So you could get into a sort of situation where stuff is being this is being pushed out, but the market still falls anyway, even though you're getting that thing. And the other option is that they just hold it on their own balance sheet. Which way do you think they're going to go with all of this?
All right. So lots to unpack there. But let's just talk about where we are now. Right. So going back to what happened with the debt ceiling crisis. Well, during the debt ceiling crisis this past spring, the Treasury didn't have money to pay the principal on debt that was maturing. All right. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have the ability to issue more debt. So they did some things internally that they were borrowing money internally. And at the same time, they were allowing some of this debt to mature and then using the Treasury General account, drawing from their checking account to pay this off. So they drew their checking account all the way down to just like $35 billion, which, like, you know, we joke about, the US government spends that before I finish my first cup of coffee in the morning. Okay. So the fact that they were that close is a little bit scary. Okay, so, but they used those exceptional measures to navigate this. Now they had to refill that. Okay, so how do they refill it? Well, they've got to spend about it. They had to raise about $1 trillion to refill that TGA back up to about $500 billion, which is where they're comfortable keeping the checking account at. Like, you don't keep, you know, $20 in your checking account, you keep a few thousand dollars in there at least in order to make sure you're making payments that are coming out automatically. Okay, same sort of idea. So as they're doing that, where are they getting that money from? Well, there's a few places that they're drawing from, and we're going to get to all of this, right? So the first place they draw from is the debt matures. Well, that most of that money is going to get reinvested into new debt. Okay, so that as that debt matures, they pay it goes right back in. Okay, and then they've got this huge, massive reservoir of the reverse repo facility, which at the time of this, you know, beginning of June, it was around $2.3 trillion of capital, which is just idle capital in banks that's parked at the Fed and making a great rate of return. Well, so what does the Treasury do? The banks are kind of, if they're up against their limits on how much they can own in treasuries, right? Because of leverage limits, and they've got internal limits and they've got external limits from the Fed. So where are they going to get that money from? Well, the reverse repo is just sitting there. Well, you can't use that reverse repo money to buy long-term debt. So they're buying short-term debt. Well, so the Treasury starts issuing short-term debt. And if you look back in June and July, they issued hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of short-term treasuries. I mean, we're talking about T-bills. You know, they're just a few weeks to a month or 2 months or 3 months old, right? Or duration. So that's already coming due. So you see the Treasury just, they're just like continuously, they're just pumping, you know, this short-term debt out there. But that winds up taking down that the reverse repo from 2.3 to 1.6 or 1.7 trillion. And so they're draining that. Well, they're going to have to start issuing long-term debt because they're just continuously issuing the short-term debt, which is at the highest interest rates, right? So they've got to figure this out. And so as they're doing this, they're also
that's a big problem, what you're talking about there. If they're going to swap out old long-term debt for new long-term debt, it's a fundamentally, I mean, what is it? It's like 5% versus 1%? I mean,
it's anywhere from 4.5% to 5.5% to, you know, versus anywhere from 0.75% to 1.5% ish, somewhere in there, right? So as these things are maturing,
that's a bit. If you're swapping out a billion at 1% for a billion at 5%, it's like you're, you know, 5x-ing the amount of debt that you've got from
an interest. And now you know why our. That's right. So now that's exactly why the interest expense is going straight up. Okay. Yeah. It's gone from just a 300 million, 400 million or billion to over to it's almost $1 trillion now. Okay.
Yeah.
For this year. Right. So, but the thing is, you also have about 40% of the debt that's on the Treasury, the Treasury books, you know, that they've put out, that they've borrowed, is coming due. It's maturing in the next 18 months. So you've got all that debt that's coming. They have no choice but to issue longer term debt, right? And so people know, you know, Bill Gross, the bond king, you know, he was known as the bond king in my hedge fund years, has said that, look, the long-term debt, the 10-year Treasury is way overpriced. Because of a few things, you know, the downgrade is just kind of a tip off that, look, you're going to have to get money. Where is it going to come from to finally get to your answer of where is this money going to come from? That when you have cash and cash like vehicles, you know, money market event. So my cash is in money markets and in T-bills. Why? Because T-bills they're not risky. They're going to get paid off. The T-bills are going to get paid off. I don't think we're going to have a debt ceiling crisis in the next month to 3 months. So that's getting paid off. But you're getting a great rate of return there. You're getting over 5% on those, right? That's as riskless as you can get right now, okay? So, but if my stock portfolio is where the risk is. So I'm not buying long-term debt. Right. The only time I'm going to buy long-term debt is when it gets to a price where I feel like it's just too juicy to ignore. And so I draw capital out of the stock market and put it there, or the stock market starts to drop and you have this drain of liquidity there because people are taking money out of the risk assets. And where are they going to put it? Well, they're going to put it in short-term treasuries, but you're reallocating to something that you feel is okay. It's not as risky as the stock market, but it is still riskier, far riskier than short term. So you see what I'm saying? So need money to come out of the risk assets to go into those long term treasuries.
But let's just tease on this a bit, because so they're issuing primarily short term debt at the moment. Okay, that makes sense because that's where the demand is and so on. If we look at the bets that the market is taking, the inverted yield curve, it would tend to imply that a lot of people out there believe that the Fed is going to have to cut rates significantly soon. So the market is basically positioned and betted for this. Now, if the fact that they're issuing so many short-term treasuries would lead me to believe that perhaps they would much rather be doing that because they understand that there is going to be a point in the not too distant future where they're going to have to drastically cut rates because they simply can't afford to be rolling over their long-term debt at these rates. So are you with where the market is on this, that there's going to be a sort of a big drop in rates coming maybe end of this year?
Yeah. So let's unpack that. So to clear it up for your listeners, you're talking about the you typically look at the spread between the 10-year treasury and the 2-year treasury, yes. right? So you take the yield of the 10-year and you subtract out the yield of the 2-year. And when the 2-year yield is higher than the 10-year yield, that means that your yield curve is not normal. I'm doing this backwards, right? So it's inverted, yeah. right? So the yield curve is going down instead of going up. So what that means is people are expecting, like you're saying, yields to be lower in the future. Well, why are they expecting that? Well, the Fed just raised rates over 5% in about a year, right? Just over a year. So that's a massive jump from just 25 basis points to over 5%. That's a massive rate raise. Okay. And we have not yet seen the effects of that in the market. And so there's those lagging effects of what investors are looking out at. They're saying there's going to be a recession. The Fed is intent on creating a deflationary event. Well, okay. So some of your listeners are saying, well, wait a minute, you just said they need long-term inflation. That's true. They do. They can't let inflation get out of control. The Fed's job is to not let inflation get out of control. The Treasury's job is to be sure that they can borrow as much as they need. So there's a kind of a push and pull there, right?
I might phrase it a little bit differently to say the Fed need credibility, and they're only willing to do this as much as is necessary to preserve their credibility. I think they're probably happy with inflation over the longer term.
But do you
accept the view that I'm leaning towards that what they're really doing is they are deliberately overdoing it on the tightening side. They are deliberately damaging the economy because they know they have to go as hard and fast as they possibly can right now, because be it end of this year or somewhere through next year, they're really going to have to push down those rates and refinance all of this debt, because otherwise it doesn't add up. I mean, is that broadly where you're...
Yeah, you just hit the punchline. Exactly. That's it. And so they know, they realize there's two things, right? So first, they need to make sure they maintain credibility by avoiding the possibility of hyperinflation, right? So you can't have inflation like you did in the 80s. That would destroy this country, right? So they have to make sure that they do not have that, okay? So how do they do that? By causing some sort of market repricing, okay? Just like you're talking about. But they're not worried about that. You see Powell get up there on that podium every few weeks, and he says that over and over and over again, he said, look, we have tools to deal with a recession, basically, is what he's saying.
Massive printer somewhere.
Correct. We have that, the printing meme, right? So they have tools, which is they can print money, they can expand the money supply and step in. And the real crux of it, though, Dan, the thing that they cannot let happen is the treasury market lockup. Because if the treasury market locks up, the entire financial system locks up across the entire world.
On a more immediate basis, they can't pay their bills as they fall due. I mean, the whole system seizes up, and you know they're not going to let it get to the point where the police who guard their offices are not getting paid.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
All over.
Okay, bye.
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 Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.